within that city or county as identified by signatures and sign-offs on the original form as prepared by the regional development officer. The OECD economic development officer for that region would sign off on a form. Now, that's another portion of my amendments, and it provides that the OECD could charge up to $500 for any application, up to $500, so that this would be absolutely expense neutral to the state. It's not going to cost the state. What the OECD regional development officer would be doing is that that regional development officer, in conjunction with the county commissioners and the city council of this city of under 10,000 people, in the county which had the high unemployment and the low per capita median income, would certify that this is a new business to Oregon and that it meets all of the other requirements. Then that business would invest in property, plant, and equipment with a life and or lease of not less than 10 years, and that equipment could be within an enterprise zone. There's no preclusion from that in this particular bill. Some of these small areas have enterprise zones, some do not. At that particular point, it would not have to be. If it's a retail business, it wouldn't even have qualified in the first place. And finally, that they will employ not less than 10 full-time employees, and that 10 full-time employees would be, number one, at 150% of the median income within that county, or at 100% of the median income within that county, plus full medical insurance benefits based upon the municipality in which they're in. That is, they can choose, the employer could choose a county a plan, a medical insurance plan similar to that provided by the county, or similar to that provided by the city in which they're located. Then annually, that business would be certified by the regional development officer as, number one, continuing in business and the type of business that it was originally directed to do, that is, not competing with other substantial identical business in the community, and number two, that they did have the 10 or more full-time employees in each of the quarterly reports. He would staple that quarterly report. This is, again, at a price of not to exceed $100 per year, that he would bring that together. He would staple that quarterly report, sign off on the quarterly report, and that annual report with the quarterly tax reports that were necessary, indicating that he had certified that for that particular year, that business had met the 9 or 10 or more full-time employees, had not dropped below 10 employees, and had continued to pay them at the 150% and or 100% with all medical insurance benefits as provided under this bill. And for that, the business would receive an exemption in that particular year from income tax, recognizing that this is all new business to Oregon. These are people that are on the tax rolls, providing property, plant, and equipment on the tax rolls, and finally, that they are providing jobs for not less than 10 full-time employees at 150% of the median income for that county. And with that, again, I am I'm very happy to be able to present this bill to you. It's my copy, and I apologize that it has not been engrossed. It is now just being heard. But my copy has a number of modifications and changes, and I do have the -3 through the -3 amendments here that provide for all of this.
Questions? I have one. Where did you come up with this?
Mr. Chair, I'm just delighted to say that this came out of the Oregon Smart Growth discussions as to how they were helping, how we could best help not just the folks in metropolitan Oregon, but the folks throughout the entire state of Oregon. And this bill, I want you to know that because this is all new business to Oregon, it provides an opportunity where this is at no cost to the taxpayers. This is business which we otherwise and working through the concentric circles, I was looking for counties, and that's why I had to expand it to the highest quartile as opposed to the highest quintile of unemployment. In order to get those two circles to have intersected at any time during this past year, I had to move that to the highest quartile of unemployment and the lowest quartile of per capita income.
And where do they intersect?
They intersected uniquely. Only in my district. No, they did not intersect in my district, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. They intersected in Wheeler County, and they intersected in Crook County. I believe one time, but there was Wheeler and Sherman, so that the organized cities of less than 10,000 would be Fossil, Mitchell, or Spray, or Grass Valley, Morrill, Rufus, or Wasco. Those would be, in 1 month, those would be the cities in which a business could qualify during that month of high unemployment. Now, recognize these are very small counties. In any case, you go to Morrill or Rufus or Wasco or Fossil or Mitchell or Spray, and you insert 10 new jobs, and incidentally, 10 new jobs, in order to have 10 full-time jobs, making sure that no one quits and leaves you with 9 on some particular morning, you're going to have probably 12. You're going to have 12 people full time. So, recognizing that could be a problem, I knew that they were going to have to hire more than 10 at full time, and they're going to have them at a high enough compensation to have met the minimum requirements in order to provide that information on the quarterly return. So what happens is that uniquely within these counties, and these are counties where they have, again, not just the unemployment issue, but also low median income, those counties then become moving targets. Certain counties would move off as other counties moved into the high quartile of unemployment. The Harney County will qualify in the high unemployment, and it'll be interesting to see what happens to their median income, median personal income, per capita median income in the next round. But this is a county which is soon at 30% unemployment, very shortly with the closures that we're experiencing there. Again, this is all very public information.
I guess my question is: does Grass Valley have the infrastructure to handle that new Saturn plant?
Ten employees, and Mr. Chair, let me say that. Let me address that. That's what this is all about. Is that it's not directed? It's not directed at areas in this state where you're going to have 15,000 new employees or even 100 new employees in the new business. These are not at communities. This is not aimed at communities like that because, number one, they don't have the infrastructure, and number two, they're in the out-of-the-way kind of places that you're just not going to be able to accommodate huge businesses. I have put 10 as the minimum number of jobs. I had toyed with the possibility of an upper limit. However, I don't want to go there as to an upper limit of jobs, because if they feel like that they can employ 25 people, and people from Mitchell or Spray have to commute to Fossil, then so be it. Or if the housewives or farm wives and husbands want to come in off the farmlands and work for a full-time compensation at 150% of the median income, they could certainly do that, and those would provide excellent employees. But I'm not after the mega corporations moving to rural Oregon.
Questions for Representative Butler, Representative Beck?
I guess I'm wondering if this might encourage development in some rural communities where maybe development ought not be encouraged.
That's an excellent question, Mr. Chair and Representative Beck. That is exactly why the original certification on this particular matter requires the signatures of the city, the county, as well as the regional development officer. And so if the city management and the city council decided that it was, and I use that as an example as I have gone around and pitch this idea to a number of people. One example that I've used is that all of a sudden, let's assume that in Bandon, Oregon, pick another, Enterprise, Oregon, or Lost Dean in Wallala County, let me pick one in my district, Burns. Somebody comes to Burns, the city of Burns or the city of Hines. There's only two organized cities in Harney County. they come to the city of Burns and Hines, and they say, we would really like to have an opportunity to set up our printing plant here. And you have some people here that could be trained to be printers, and we'll bring in a few printers, and they'll buy up homes in your communities. And so then the county, the regional development officer says, here's somebody that wants to put 20 jobs in Hines, Oregon, and rushes down to the Hines folks, and he says, they qualify, they're already printing in California, and the county needs the jobs, and you've just lost the FMC plant. And so what happens is that these folks then go to the city and go before the city, and they say, and tell us again what it is that you print. And they say, well, we print Dirty Girly magazines. And that's something that we do really well at in California. We'd like to bring it right here to River City in your back door. Well, the city management then can make the decision whether or not that's a business that they feel like competes unfairly. In their exclusive decision, they can say, no, that competes unfairly with our newspaper, which is printed on Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say that I've been not listening a lot, but my interest is all of a sudden very piqued on this show. Representative Billy, what section of the bill are you looking at there, the local government participation?
Let's see.
There we are.
It's what, 6 on top of page 3?
Yeah.
Bottom of page 2 and the top of page 3.
No, Max.
Well, and I'm looking too on page 2, lines 12 through 17. Governing body of the county may object if they're incompatible with existing businesses, not in keeping community.
That's exactly right.
And employment standards.
And it's in their sole discretion, Mr. Chair, that the city and the county have the right to. The county may very well want it, and the city may not. And in the case of the Burns-Hines situation, maybe if the folks couldn't get Hines to sign off, maybe Burns would go ahead and say, we really don't care what they're printing as long as it's shipped out of the community. However, it gives the community an opportunity to go ahead and choose the kinds of businesses that land there.
Well, let me ask, okay, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to follow up on my, what I was really getting at is, you know, there's only so much to go around, and to the extent we're trying to target economic development in rural communities, two communities that have infrastructure, have roads, have fiber, I'm wondering if there's the potential in this bill that some communities that may not really be places that are the best places to be making investments, and it's hard for a county and a rural and a regional economic development staff person to say no for political reasons or whatever, and that this bill enables businesses to maybe locate in places when they really might want them in LeGrand or Burns versus a Morrow or
the big cities.
Or Bonaire, or
Granite.
I don't know, it's its own district. You know, there's some places where I think we want to encourage that critical mass, and I would be a little concerned if this creates a little competitive bidding war, and the powers that be really don't. It's hard to say no sometimes in some of these local communities, and yet sometimes you really need to be directing this to places where the infrastructure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beck, we're in the process over in economic development hearings right now as to how to advance nearly $200 million to some of these small communities to take care of rural infrastructure issues so that they'll be able to meet the minimum requirements that they presently have. And again, recognize that these are in communities where there is high unemployment, and consequently there are already people that are living there and that are using the streets, they're using the sewers, using the systems on a regular and daily basis. I'm not seeking the 100 job or the 500 job kinds of operations. I'm seeking for folks to bring in opportunities to come to rural Oregon. There was a, or I say rural Oregon, any distressed community, and that The counties that I immediately identified include rural counties in both sides of the state. Coos County, Curry County, Josephine County, Klamath County also are counties which do fall under some of the low median income or high unemployment. Not necessarily concentric. The maximum that I could ever get concentric, where this was, and incidentally that's on the, both in the explanation of the bill as well as down on line 15 on page 1, that or should be and, so that the circles are concentric, as to the intersection of those two circles, then that's where we have these businesses that could qualify as they move into those particular areas.
Let me ask a couple questions on the certification at the local government level. I'm not sure that the local government could decline on the basis of, let's say, the Gurley magazine publisher. Wouldn't that be a content-based First Amendment kind of issue? Say we're not going to allow you into town because you print the wrong kind of magazines. And I guess the question is then, I don't know what else is in the economic development statutes, but don't we need some sort of standards there? Can we give local governments a standardless basis to approve or disapprove?
Mr. Chair, what you're seeking for is, and my concern was that it not be in direct competition with someone else that is in the community already doing that particular service. In other words, if you've got a grocery store that is in the community, but it's an old, run-down grocery store, and you've got other community that's built up around this particular town, and you thought, well, I could go ahead and run a grocery store and put 15 full-time employees in it, that would then be in competition with Jake's grocery store that's been there for 50 years. And the city could then say, we just feel like it would create some unfair competition for Jake's grocery, as much as you would like to have that business there. Now, I will say this, in that process, those folks have to make that decision whether or not they feel like it's in direct competition. And I wanted their decision, the local decision, as to the county and the city. It may be that the city of Vail would very much like to have a brand new printing plant or a plant that does, and incidentally there are businesses that do, I understand, plastic die molding, that manufacture the die that go for plastic molding. Well, there happens to be one of those in this Oregon. If somebody came and said, hey, we can employ 20 people in Vail, Oregon, and there is one already in this Oregon, Vail would very much like to have those 20 jobs land in there. But if there's already one that employs 5 full-time people in Nyssa, the county looks at that and says, we like the one we've got. We're not willing to sign off on it to allow this business to come to our county.
Other questions? Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative,
$25,000 per capita income in Harney County might be equivalent to $35,000 per capita income in Washington County, simply because cost of living and consequently wages are higher in metropolitan areas. Wouldn't it be more appropriate to base this on unemployment rates instead of also having a reliance on median income rates, which really don't reflect uniformly around the state?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Witt. The unemployment rates certainly are there as to the unemployment percentages, but I did originally this had a provision for median family income, and let me just pull up the median family income, for instance, for Wallowa County at $35,000, but the median individual income, that's the per capita income in Wallowa County, is $19,636. Coming back to your question, could people do just as well and on $19,636 in Wallowa County as they could in Multnomah County at $30,662 per capita income? I don't know that you have 50% higher, and incidentally Gilliam County is the lowest at $14,353, which is just half of what Multnomah and half of Clackamas and half of Washington County at over $30,000 per county.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I follow up.
Yeah.
Representative, I would simply make a point that standard of living has to be related to cost of living, not just to the wages that are earned. And it seems to me by using this per capita income figure as part of the determination as to which counties or which cities and counties will qualify, inherently becomes an unfair or unequal way to apply this. It seems to me that unemployment rates, on the other hand, would be uniform in terms of how they would apply. I mean, if the unemployment rate's 10% in one county and 10% in another county, that's uniform. I mean, you can't argue about it meaning more in one county and less in another county, whereas these per capita wages don't mean the same things in all counties because you're using an absolute number, whereas the cost of living is a relative factor.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I would love to have the per capita income increased throughout the state, and I think that this bill has the potential and the capacity of increasing the per capita income throughout the state. And yes, it may cost less in allow Mount here, Baker, Morrow, Jefferson, Sherman, Wheeler, and Gilliam to live, but does it cost 50% as much to live as it does? I don't think so. Okay. I think it probably takes more than that. I think that those are factors, again, of the fact that we have very low wages and high unemployment and people willing to take most anything they can get to work and many times several jobs in order to bring their wages just up to this low median income.
Mr. Chairman, yeah. I would just make the point that the representative is confirming what I said. You know, he's asking, is it 40-50% more to live in Multnomah County than in Wallowa County? Well, I'm not sure, but he's acknowledging that it does cost more to live in Multnomah County than in Wallowa County, and which means that we're using this per capita income as a relative number, but in an absolute way here. I'm just suggesting, Representative, that the unemployment rate seems to me to be the right one to focus on here.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, I absolutely will concede that it costs more to live in Clackamas County. Does it cost 100% more? And I don't know that. I don't know that, but I do know that the standard of living that may be enjoyed in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington, all over 30,000, and a whole group of counties of less than 20 and some less than 15, it does cost as much for insurance, for instance. I don't know that there's any great difference in health insurance, life insurance, automobile gasoline. It probably is more expensive out in our rural areas than it is in town.
You don't have to drive 5 miles to your mailbox.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, I think insurance rates are higher in bigger cities. It's auto insurance rates.
I just have a couple more, then we'll have to get on. But Representative Butler, the new business activity, I wonder if you've given any thought to new entities to operate as new businesses and how that fits in with this?
Mr. Chair, absolutely yes. This question came up recently as I was discussing this, and it would not be uncommon to think that an entity which presently is receiving a goodly portion of standby product which is used in their particular business that they're receiving from another country or another state may very well decide that they can produce that themselves here within the state of Oregon. They could easily have a spin-off company at that particular point and have that company spun off and actually do business right here in the state of Oregon. That's new business to Oregon. That's business which we're not presently providing. It's a service or business which is presently produced out of state. Regional Economic Development Officer would be able to authenticate that and the $500 fee that's set up, that in fact this is a new business, it's new to Oregon, and they're establishing it either as a member of the board of directors or a subsidiary of the existing company. Remember that this applies to all types of businesses. It applies to partnerships, corporations, LLCs, LLPs, individual sole proprietorships, and so forth.
And you, I thought you looked like you moved your hand. Okay. No, I guess, but the other thing I was thinking of, you got Jake's Market in downtown Nissa. What's to stop Mrs. Jake from, Jake's wife from opening up a store in Vail and qualifying, making application for this?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. If it's brand new business to Oregon, and these folks, these folks are presently already located in, in NISA and decide that they want a second store in Vail, there's absolutely nothing to preclude them from do that. Recognize that what they're doing is they're providing employment and they're providing new capital infrastructure, new capital to be on the tax rolls, and because it's a retail business, it'll be 100% on the tax rolls. And you're going to provide those wages at 150% of the median per capita income at that particular point. What happens is if Mrs. Jake doesn't quite make any money, then there's no tax benefit for them to have done what they've done, because you've basically provided them a loss for an opportunity. And I think what you've got is you've come full circle to about where I've come to, and that is I was looking at this, could I have attracted the FMC Corporation to come to Oregon, to come to Burns, Oregon, assuming that FMC was enticed into Burns, Oregon, to stay to Burns, Oregon, moving their operations out of California. Well, they're not making enough money right now to evidently stay in business in Burns, Oregon. Yeah. If they were making any money at all, under this bill, it would be tax-free. If they're not making money, then it's a loss, and it's not subject to tax anyway, income tax.
Representative Bates.
I'm sorry I had to leave, Mr. Chairman. Representative Butler, I was called out. When I look at this bill, I think, of course, as we all do, our own areas. And I've got small cities in my district that are dying on the vine for lack of employment. But they probably wouldn't qualify under this, and that concerns me. It sounds like Prospect and Butte Falls, which used to be timber towns, and now have empty homes, good schools that are empty or partially empty, good infrastructure ready to go. And it's very difficult for them to attract business to keep people in the towns and making a living. The county as a whole is doing reasonably well because of Ashland and Medford. But these towns are an hour and a half away from those towns, and in one case, 2 hours away. And it's a real problem. Was there any discussion about opening this up to smaller communities in which the county was doing reasonably well, but an outlying community, substantially outlying community, would have any benefit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bates, that's an excellent question. And the answer to the question is no. And the reason is that what you have within Jackson County is you have family median income of 38,000, which is in the top half of the state, and at that particular point, we couldn't target that particular county as being within one of these concentric circles, even within one of the circles. However, it's anticipated that perhaps over time, if you could pick up 15 or 20 jobs in three or four communities on a regular basis in these distressed areas, two things happen. Number one, you will reduce unemployment, and the unemployment percentage will begin to drop, and you'll drop out of that circle. And the second thing, of course, that happens is the other circle, and that is because you're paying 150% of the median income, then the income to that county, the average per capita income increases. And so maybe one day at that point, new businesses could come to those areas, but I don't see that happening. I really don't. That's the particular point. It may not ever arrive in those communities.
All right. Thank you very much. And you've got some amendments.
We have some amendments, and I'd be delighted to continue to work with Legislative Revenue Staff, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. Does anybody else wish to be heard on House Bill 3770? All right, then we will close the public hearing. Thank you again, Representative Butler, for joining us today. Is anybody here on 2729? All right. It's been a work session on 2729.
Yeah, Ramona's office, I was told.
Jim Craven. Ed, is that you too?
That's me.
Please, bring us up to date.
She wants to open the show.
House Bill 2729. As you will recall, expands the qualified research and alternative research tax credits to include all types of business organizations in any field of research. Currently, only advanced fields are eligible, and only C corporations can claim a credit. But the bill also aligns the computation of the research tax credits with the computation of the federal tax credit in general. And it increases the maximum credit allowed from $500,000 under current law to $500,000 plus 25% of tax liability in excess of $500,000.
Okay. Jim Craven.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I guess I have to inquire as to whether there are any amendments available at this point. I do not have a copy. Using my speed reading techniques.
So we have dash twos and dash fives. Ed, do you want to tell us about what we've got here?
Sure, Mr. Chair.
I'll read them.
Dash five amendments basically replace the original bill and insert a straight extension of the sunsets on the two research credits. Under current law, they both sunset at the end of 2001.
Where'd my committee go? They're out. I looked down and I looked up and we're both here.
We need one more.
Yeah, we do need one more.
In an R and D, it's okay.
let's be in recess for a second. Do we get some people back? Is there any explanation of that? Okay, we're back in. Jim, if you want to... Oh, wait. Ed, you were telling us about the amendments. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 5 amendments are gut and stuff. It replaces the original bill with language that extends the sunsets on the two...
Okay.
Under the Dash 5, the sunset would be extended through December 31, 2007. Under current law, the credit sunset at the end of 2001.
Jim.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, briefly, when we had the public hearing, I think it was last week, we testified, and I think it was verified by staff and the chair, that an extension of the existing current law as is, basically the language represented by the Dash 5s, would represent a revenue impact that is currently covered by the governor's proposed budget. I think it's roughly in the order of $3.6 million in talking to staff. And the issue came up as to whether the bill as substantially pared down in the Dash 5s. The printed bill was a more substantive, some might say grandiose concept.
Dreamlike.
In working with the chair, members of the committee, and with the governor's office, that this bill, I believe, is more in line with the version that the governor in his tax expenditure report did give the green light to. And it is our understanding that at this level, as amended by the Dash 5, this bill is included within the governor's and co-chair's budget. So I believe these amendments were adopted at the request of the chair, and we would encourage you to keep the bill alive and move it along. We can have further discussions as the session ensues, I suppose.
Thank you, Jim. For the committee, that's correct. When we looked at the Dash 2 amendments that were before us, last time we heard this, we were looking at a $28 million revenue impact in 2001-03, going up to $80 million in 2005-07. And I think it was represented to us then correctly that that obviously went further than the governor's budget, but the governor did anticipate an extension of the sunset of the current credit, and that is what the Dash 5s accomplish, just an extension of the current credit. Ed, can you explain you've got here a revenue, you've got here. Whew. You have indicated a revenue impact of $3.7 million for the 0103 biennium, and a note that the governor's budget includes $3.5 million. Are we in the ballpark?
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, normally that would be in the ballpark. With the current anticipated revenue situation, I don't know. It's not my call. The difference.
Actually, the marriage penalty bill will pay for that.
That's
sounds good.
The difference is that since the time the governor's budget came out, there's some additional data that showed utilization of the research credit during the 1999 tax year, and the levels were up a little bit from what we had seen before that.
Okay. Well, committee, I think we're where we've been on some of these others before. If the committee is so inclined, I would support a move to the floor and then to the Senate, pending the revenue forecast next week, to have this in line. It is anticipated in the governor's budget, and I think in the co-chair's budgets as well. But then to have this basically on the table for the rebalance effort, balancing revenues with appropriations for the coming biennium. But that would be the chair's inclination anyway. But we are a committee. What's the pleasure?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Williams.
I would move the dash 5 amendments to the bill.
Representative Williams moves the dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2729. Is there discussion on that? Any objection? Okay, they are in. Representative Williams.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2729 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Williams moves House Bill 2729 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion on that motion? Okay, then please call the roll.
Representative
Tate.
Aye.
Staff.
Excuse.
Brown.
Aye.
Hatch. Hughes.
Williams.
Aye. Whip.
Aye.
Vice
Chair Carlson.
Aye.
Safari. Aye. Chair Satterley. Aye. House Bill 2729, as amended, goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Do we have a carrier? Volunteer?
Carry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Williams to carry. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I thought we had a new policy. If you're out of the room, you were the carrier. my staff
was
that yesterday.
Oh, I'd want to know that Representative Beck's heart was in it. Okay, we are then to Senate Bill 397. That's going to be carried over. Do we have some folks who want to speak on that today while it's on the agenda? Okay, committee, you'll remember that is the unemployment insurance rates bill. They're crunching some numbers and we'll be back to us. I think is that on the schedule for next Tuesday? Is that what it is? Okay, yeah, it's back on the schedule. Come back then. So in that case, unless somebody speaks up now and says they want to speak on 397, we'll just pass over that on the agenda. And that brings us down to House Bill 2131. I'm sorry, 2730. Let's do that. Juan, do you want to come up? Open a work session on House Bill 2730. Ed, do you want to bring us up to date on that one?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, House Bill 2730 creates an investment tax credit, that is, the tax credit for qualified investments in tangible personal property. The credit is computed as 10% of qualified investments, not to exceed 25% of the tax liability of the taxpayer, with a 7-year carry forward for unused portions. The credit would become effective beginning the 2002 tax year under the base bill.
And we have some amendments.
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Juan, do you want to introduce those, or do you want Ed to introduce
them? I actually have not seen the amendments.
Okay, then I won't ask you to.
Thank you.
Ed, we have dash 2s and dash 3s.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The dash 2s are in response to requests from the chair during the week to try and incorporate the gist of Representative Butler's concept from House Bill 3770.
Well, Representative Bates will want to listen. Representative Witt, I think, will want to listen to this, right? We're incorporating the gist of Representative Butler's approach.
Yeah, we're trying to get our twos and threes.
Okay, sorry.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
These were actually the original amendments that we proposed.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Can you give her the threes anyway? So Fawn, you know the twos.
Well.
No, she doesn't.
Yeah, they just cut them out.
Okay, actually.
I'm sorry.
No, the dash ones were the ones that we originally proposed that had the different unemployment rate.
Yeah, Ed, why don't you take us through these? Let's get, make sure we're all up to date on what these do.
Okay, Mr. Chair, the dash ones were distributed
last
week on April 25th. And what they do is they set the graduated credit amount for investments based on the unemployment level in the area where the investment occurs. So the base credit in everyday relatively average or prosperous area would be 10% of qualified investment. That would graduate up to 50% credit for qualified investments placed into an area with an unemployment rate that exceeds the state average unemployment rate by 6% or more, 6 percentage points, I guess, or more.
Okay.
So it's greater incentive for investments in relatively job-stressed areas. The Dash 2 amendments are based on conversations with the chair, and what they try to do is incorporate Representative Butler's concept that he presented earlier in House Bill 3770, except that instead of an income exemption, the mechanism is an investment credit. It would be effective 2002 through 2007 tax years. And one technical change, it uses a per capita personal income measure instead of the median family income measure that was discussed in the House Bill 3770.
And the threes?
The threes just came in, and they narrow the definition of qualified investments to mean depreciable property of a type that would be excluded from taking the federal investment tax credit under the terms of the Tax Reform Act of 1986. And I haven't had an opportunity to figure out what exactly that means.
Okay. Go on.
Well, for the record, my name is Fawn McNeely. I'm representing the Smart Growth Coalition, which includes Adidas, Columbia Sportswear, Intel, KinderCare, Louisiana Pacific, Nike, Tektronix, and Schnitzer Steel. We brought this bill to you about 2 weeks ago, and members of the committee expressed interest in developing some type of pilot program or targeted investment tax strategy. So that's what we came up with the Dash 2s, I believe. I think that the program is pretty limited. I believe the chair had requested a cap of $1 million, and each company can take a 10% investment tax credit up to $50,000. Our coalition came up with three ideas when meeting about economic development issues. This was the third idea. We wanted to see how we could target some investment in these economically depressed areas to find a way to create a stronger economy throughout the state. That's what we have here for you today. I know that this is Representative Witt's bill, so he might have something to say about it.
Oh, I bet he does. Representative Witt? No, I'm sorry, maybe not.
I will in time, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, I tell you, I having heard the testimony on House Bill 3770, I'm a little less enamored of moving all of those various qualifiers and criteria into this bill, but I think something that still is targeted at the distressed counties is still a worthwhile proposition, and I'd appreciate maybe some comments and conversations from the committee as how to best get there, keeping the revenue impact on this as low as possible. We've got in here $1 million cap as it is, but maybe a better way to target this.
Well,
again, after we heard the testimony on 3770.
Our original amendments to the bill had suggested unemployment as the way to figure out who got the investment tax credit, and we're more than willing to go with that. It was at your...
Yeah, I know. It's my fault. I said, after having heard the testimony today, let me just throw out... what about the something along the lines of the Dash 1s, but with a cap in it at the same time? Representative Witt?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think that's a good idea. I think the percentage and the dash ones, frankly, is too high. I think the federal, it isn't it true, the federal ITC was 10% at its highest rate when it was in existence prior to 86?
Mr. Witt, I'm not sure. Perhaps someone from the Department of Revenue has...
I think it was. I think it was maximum 10%. So what I would suggest to make this available, if we want to cap this at $1 million and make this available particularly in areas of high unemployment, what we might want to do is we might want to lower the percentage in these various categories and maybe even zero it out in the Section D and make it so that way it's a smaller credit per business and maybe cap it per business entity so that more businesses will have the opportunity to take advantage of it. In other words, modify the dash ones to lower the percentages somewhat and cap the maximum credit per business entity. And I think we still need the dash threes because I think they're technical fixes to make sure that there are certain controls put in place that were similar to the controls put in place under the federal law. And the Department of Revenue helped me with that. I think they helped us dash the dash threes. The dash threes aren't so much substantive as they are remedial. They're corrective.
So your idea would be to address the rates that are set out in the dash ones.
That's correct.
Then apply a per business cap.
Yes, yes, Mr. Chair, and then adopt the dash threes as a separate amendment.
I think in the dash twos, in looking at Section 7, we have both a per business cap and an aggregate cap, $1 million.
Chairman Shiley, it was a 10% investment tax credit up to $50,000.
Okay.
Oh, in the bill.
In the dash
threes. The dash twos, yeah. So you could do that. You could accomplish, I think, all three of those. Yeah.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if you give me a little time, I'd be willing to work on this and, you know, kind of get this in a position where we can cap it per business entity. We could direct it primarily in areas of high unemployment, and we can lower the percentages here to something that's still meaningful but will allow it to be used by more businesses in those high unemployment areas. And we can come up with a dash four that would address those substantive issues, and then, of course, the dash three for the more technical issues.
I'm comfortable with that. Comments from Committee Representative Kifori?
Well, I have a comment maybe to back up a bit. Now, I don't know if I missed this in a previous hearing, but have we heard from the Department, Economic Development Department, about what, I mean, are we doing this in conjunction with other programs that are going on, or is this just a...
Why don't we invite the Department to come forward? Glad you're in the room. Mm-hmm. Economic Development Day in the Revenue Committee.
Mr. Saturday, members of the committee, I think I'm glad I'm in the room as well. We have...
Oh, sorry, name and...
Oh, yes. I'm Mike Burton. I'm the Assistant Director of the Economic and Community Development Department. We have been involved in conversations with proponents of this bill. We've been involved in conversations with the Department of Revenue. We support the concept of both this bill and 3770 in terms of providing incentive for economic activity in rural and distressed or depressed parts of the state. There are significant barriers to doing business out there, and if the state is able to find ways to address those barriers, we think it's all for the better. I'd like to just editorialize and say that I think one of the important benefits of that is that we don't have to get into a value judgment of whether or not a community deserves to live. I think we can talk about a benefit of economic activity and the ability to make a living in any rural and distressed communities in terms of the avoided cost of dealing with those folks when they move to Portland, Salem, Eugene, and not get into the moral issue about whether or not we need to keep Pines alive or whatever the community chooses today. But we feel that there is significant benefit in this bill. We are not fully up to speed with what the consequences would be to our department in terms of staffing and the efforts we would need to undertake in order to certify businesses as qualified. So we would be happy to be involved in discussions to that end. We believe that this is a valid approach and welcome an opportunity to participate in that.
Representative Curry, want to follow up?
Yeah, thank you.
And while you're doing that, if I could ask Ed Heber to come on forward.
What tools and means do you have at your disposal currently to encourage businesses or assist businesses to locate in areas such as our tribe.
Representative Corey, Chair Shetterly. The department has an array of tools. In most of these communities, as you heard in the discussion on House Bill 3630, there may be questions of infrastructure or the ability of the community to actually support business ventures. Many of our tools allow us to assist communities in financing the basis for economic activity, whether it be water systems, sewer systems, roads. You know, varies with the community, but most of our investment activities are in those areas. We also have a fairly limited array of incentives. We believe that, in general, Oregon's competitive in terms of its business environment. Some of our incentives address the enterprise zone is on the agenda for later in this meeting. It's meant to address an imbalance in the Oregon tax structure, which has a disproportionate amount of the state's income, not the state's, but general income to the governments in the state, coming from a property tax mechanism, which is a penalty, which provides a penalty to businesses that are capital intensive or end up paying a lot of income tax. So we have a fairly tailored incentive package. This would be another tool in that box, and I think to that end, it's a useful product.
Representative Bates, and then Whit.
Just real quickly, I'm still concerned about how communities would qualify for this. If we do it on a county basis, there's a lot of counties that have pockets of real poverty and difficulty, and other areas of the county doing quite well. And those areas are often quite far apart, hour and a half, 2 hours. And I would want to craft this in a way that small cities or communities in counties that were doing reasonably well would have an opportunity to take advantage of this. Obviously, my own county, I'm thinking of several locations, but I'm sure there's other ones in other counties that would suffer the same problems. And if we use this narrow concentric circles we've been talking about, you're not going to open up the rural part of the state that really needs help. And I assume you probably have data that would help support that.
Representative Bates, Chair Shetterly. The department recognizes that problem. It's most apparent in counties. Most of the data is collected on a countywide basis, so it starts us off with a bias looking at counties. The problem is most apparent in counties like Jackson County or Marion Polk counties or Lane County, where there's a large metropolitan center, but there are communities that are not proximate to that center. And the department has adopted a methodology that is based on 8 factors that are distressed area index. It does allow for sub-jurisdictional determination of distress. To this date, only the City of Portland and Lane County have elected to pursue a sub-jurisdictional determination of distress. In many cases, it's because there's potentially a stigma or a black eye attached to that distress.
That'd be my district.
but I don't think that's applicable in the Butte Falls Prospect situation, where it's just a long ways from part of the county that we have healthy. So we would support a methodology that uses that determinant of depression or distress.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. That would be very acceptable to me.
Representative Whit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't understand why this would create any kind of a fiscal impact for the department. All we're talking about here in the bill now, the way we're talking about it, as I understand it, is simply determining the unemployment rate and applying an investment tax credit based upon that unemployment rate for an investment in property that would qualify. So I don't think that. I think that's a Department of Revenue issue, simply to write the rules to support the credit. I don't think it involves OECDD in any way that would create any kind of a fiscal impact.
Representative Whit, Chair Shetterly, we have not seen the amendment, so we're not clear on what the role is that's prescribed for the department. I have seen the Dash 2 amendments, which have a role for the department in that we would pre-certify firms, depending on how many of those there may be.
Don't worry about that.
Okay.
Deborah, do you want to comment on the Dash 3s and some of this discussion?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. I contacted Representative Witt's office with some concerns about the original bill after listening to testimony at the last hearing. Specifically, we were concerned about recapture provisions that did exist for the federal law but weren't in this bill, and then also some anti-churning rules and some rules around related party transactions. And all of that was primarily to prevent what we would consider abuse of the credit by a person who might buy a piece of equipment, claim the credit, a month later sell it, or negotiations between family members, or taking a sole proprietorship and converting that to a C corp and selling all of the equipment and claiming the credit. I'm not saying that this is the best result. This was pretty quick, and it is based on what the federal rules were around the recapture. It may be more to your liking to take the credit and spread it over a period of time rather than forcing the taxpayer to recapture if they dispose of the property. But I think that's a question that perhaps Representative Witt would want to consider.
Thoughts? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, just if it's okay, I'd like to conceptually run by what I had in mind.
Yeah.
What I'm looking at is have a maximum of a 20% credit where you have employment rates that have unemployment that is more than 4% above a state average, 10% where the unemployment rates are more than 2% above the state average. In other locales, the credit wouldn't apply, and the maximum credit would be not to exceed, and I'm thinking of either $25,000 or $50,000 per business per year, and then cap the credit at $1 million. Was it per year or per biennium that we were looking
at? I think it was biennium.
Per biennium. That way, the relief would all go to investments that are made in counties with more with unemployment rates 2% or more above the state average. We'd cap the credit at some reasonable number per business entity. That way, the $1 million per biennium could be spread out to more businesses within these areas of the state that have higher unemployment.
And that would seem to take care of OEDD's issues too about right. About being involved in the fiscal impact there. Okay, and then maybe while we're getting those done, if you want to work with Deborah on fixing the dash threes even better.
Question.
Yeah, Representative Bates.
I think it was just a slip of the tongue, but we discussed the possible using the idea of a distressed area, not a county, with an unemployment rate of a certain level. Would that be something you'd be interested to look at for us?
Mr. Chairman, I have concerns about how you quantify that data. I mean, unemployment is done on a county basis. If we're going to use unemployment, it seems to me the at least the only numbers I'm familiar with are coming out of counties. And also I would make the point that in a given county, Representative, if you have a city at the western edge of the county maybe that has 8% unemployment and you have a city in the middle of the county that has 3% unemployment, it tells me that you have people that are the jobs are being pulled into this place that has the 3% unemployment from the city that has 8% unemployment. It seems to be somewhat corrective. Me. Now, yeah, I appreciate your experience might be differently, but unless I know there's some reasonable way to get that data on something sub-county, on a sub-county basis, it's pretty hard to use that information that's not available.
I understand your reasoning. I understand that some rural counties, you would consider them a different county entirely. It's almost like you have, in actual fact, two different counties. The Medford area is doing well. 2 hours away, same county, Prospect is suffering, and people there are unemployed and looking for jobs or getting ready to move out of the area entirely, usually to not to Medford, but to Salem, Eugene, or Portland, looking for work, especially young people do that. And so we're looking for a way here that a community like Prospect, which you normally would have thought of as a county of low employment, in fact is functioning in that area because of distances involved. You indicated you have a method for looking at that. I would like to have you at least present it to Representative Witt so he could consider that. If you found it too cumbersome, I would accept that. But at least I would ask you at least take a good look at it and give us an opportunity for small communities in counties that are doing well but are geographically large to have an opportunity to take advantage of this program.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah.
I'd be happy to look at whatever information is given to me for that purpose.
Representative Kifuri.
I was just going to echo Representative Bates' comments. I think that the department already has some criteria that's set up. They've been using it. That's their job. I mean, that's what this agency does, and I would hate for us to create an entire, and that's why I asked the questions about is this going to be helpful to them. I don't want to create a new program with new criteria that
is that over here? Well, what they're doing is over here. So I think it makes sense to kind of combine and coordinate you. So I would appreciate if we could look at that.
I think we have agreement to see what we can do on that, and then in one way or another, bring this back as soon as we can get it, so we get this moving out. Representative Bates, if it's any cold comfort to you, I see Jackson County is not even on the list, so prospect will not be discriminated against within the county. Okay, thank you very much. With that, does anybody else want to jump in real quickly on 27:30? If not, we'll close that work session, and we will open a work session on 2131, House Bill 2131. Elizabeth. Please bring us up to date.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2131, you do have a new amendment. It's a dash A6. It's very similar to the dash A4 that we saw before, dealing with the Indian reservations. So I made a quick handout just to make sure we're all on the same page with this taxation on Indian reservations. So it just starts with taxation issues on Indian reservations. So to clarify and go through some of the basics with Indian reservation land that's held in trust with the federal government, this is tax exempt than all real and personal property that is owned by the Indian tribe or individual members is tax exempt also. But non-tribal businesses with property, and the property can be on trust land, they do not pay property taxes on the trust land itself, but they do pay property taxes on the buildings and personal property that is owned by the non-tribal businesses. So that is taxable. What you also see is that all local districts will be assessing taxes on the value of those buildings and personal property that is owned by non-tribal businesses. And what we see in a lot of the reservations is most of that land that is taxable, or most of the value that is taxable, is utility value. Currently, since this bill is dealing with the Umatilla and the Warm Springs reservations, I've got some data here on just what currently is being taxed on those two reservations. And what you see, like with this first table here, is that utilities are the significant portion of the value on the Warm Springs reservation at $162.6 million, with a property tax revenue of $1.96 million. And then on the Umatilla reservation, again, there's various utilities comprising about $102 million in assessed value, $1.6 million in property taxes. So again, with this particular bill, what you're going to be having is there's some aspects of the enterprise zone which are the same in the sense it's just the new construction and new additions on existing property or new facilities that are brought to the reservation, which would actually be getting the benefit, and in this particular case, it's an income tax credit. So again, for the traditional enterprise zones, you have cities and counties which are sponsoring the enterprise zones, but with this A6 and the Indian reservation enterprise zone, you're having an Indian tribe which is sponsoring that enterprise zone. It's considered to be a non-urban enterprise zone. And then under traditional enterprise zones, they exist for 10 years, and then they have a maximum square footage mileage requirement. And with the A6 amendment, it's not, again, these zones are non-urban enterprise zones, and they are referring to the statutes which require zones to be for 10 years and have 12-mile square footage requirement. So assuming that the Indian reservation zones have to meet those same requirements as the traditional enterprise zones, but that's not specifically stated in the amendment. Also, with eligible businesses and the traditional enterprise zone, eligible businesses have to produce a good for other businesses. It can't be produced for the public. So, but what we see is the criteria for eligible businesses in the Indian reservation enterprise zone is it's broader, and it can be for businesses that are dealing with services for the public. And with the traditional enterprise zones, you've got the 3 to 5 year property tax exemption on new construction or new businesses in the area. and that becomes then a loss in local revenue. But what you see with this Indian Reservation Enterprise Zone is for the criteria that's established there for the eligible businesses, there's no property tax exemption. But there could be a property tax exemption if the business can also qualify as an eligible enterprise, as an eligible business under the existing statutes. In particular, it's ORS 285D-707. So this is something that was not real clear from the last public hearing about whether or not there would be a property tax exemption.
So does that mean, for instance, that if it's a business that's producing a good for another business,
yeah,
then it would qualify for the property tax exemption because that is what qualifies it under the traditional enterprise zone?
Mr. Chairman.
If it's a business that's selling goods to the public or services to the public, it may qualify for the income tax
credit,
but not for a property tax exemption.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct, yes. And then when you have so much utility property, utilities could qualify under existing law under the 3 to 5 year property tax exemption. So those are the type of businesses that could get a property tax exemption in addition to this income tax credit. So again, the income tax credit that is given in A6 is it's provided for the businesses equal to the amount of the tribal taxes that are paid, and I've put here on new construction of eligible businesses because that's always been what has been stated, but we really need a clarifying statement in the amendment to really make this clear that we are just talking about the new any property taxes that would be assessed on just the new construction of the eligible business, not just all tribal taxes that are paid by the eligible business in a given year, because for some of these utilities, they, in particular Umatilla Reservation, already assesses a property tax of 5% of the value of the non-tribal property. So on this $102 million in Umatilla, you've got about a $5 million tribal tax amount for that particular eligible business. So in that case, if you just want this credit to be for the new construction, that needs to be stated clearer. There also is no limit on the number of years of this income tax credit. Again, the zone may last for just 10 years, but then there is no termination of this particular income tax credit. So as far as the revenue impact from this, what you could see is that in these two counties, Jefferson and Umatilla, where they have the two reservations, there could be some local districts which would lose local revenue if an eligible business in the reservation enterprise zone could also qualify as an eligible business under existing enterprise zone statutes. And the revenue reduction in the state general fund from this measure really does depend on the amount of new construction in the reservation zone, as well as the amount of tribal taxes that are imposed by each Indian tribe. And if you assume that the same property tax rate in Warm Springs that has already exists in Umatilla Reservation, and then you look at just even the utility value and thinking of it in terms of the amount of depreciation, maybe there's 6% depreciation on these facilities and then they add new construction each year, then this would result in an income tax credit of $952,119 in the 2003-05 biennium.
Okay. Sorry.
I understand.
I do. Actually, first, before we get into the A6s, I want to bring up the hero of Salem, because he's been here all day, and he wants to speak, and I told him he could, but not about the A6s, though, probably. Mayor Swaim, I don't know if you all, come on up, Mike. I don't know if you all saw the article about Mayor Swaim in the paper. Rescued a Chariots bus driver the other day.
Wow.
From an accident and pulled him out of the bus and your dog too, didn't you? You're walking your dog.
Yeah, that was an exciting moment.
Yeah, we are honored to be in your presence. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Of course, you embarrassed me with all of that, Chair Shetterly, but thank you very much, and thank you to the committee for the courtesy extended to allow me to speak this afternoon on House Bill 2131. For the record, my name is Mike Swaim. I have the privilege of serving as the mayor of Salem, and I'm here on behalf of our city council to testify in favor of House Bill 2131A, the Enterprise Zone Statute, and it's a subject that our council has been delving into in some great measure recently. We are wondering, in this kind of unique tax revenue time, certainly property taxes being capped and the effects of Measures 5, 47, and 50 playing out with the abilities of cities to be able to afford services for their citizens, we've got to be looking everywhere and making sure that our various programs really function the way that they're supposed to. In the course of that investigation, I came across a report from Dr. Tony Ruffalo, a professor at Portland State University, commissioned by the Oregon Economic Development Department on the functioning of enterprise zones in the state of Oregon and across the country in general. And what Dr. Ruffalo found was that the premise of the enterprise zones, that they are to help in areas that are economically distressed, is still a valid strategy. But the, what has happened, in fact, is that the enterprise zones have proliferated amongst the various communities and throughout the states, and in many instances have become nothing much more than subsidies to corporations without necessarily addressing the issues of any sort of distressed economy. And we find that during the 80s, we were a distressed economy here in the city of Salem, as many areas throughout the state of Oregon were, and these made a lot of sense. In the 1990s, we were not as distressed economy, but we had a lot of assessed property value that was not on the tax rolls because our entire industrially zoned property is an enterprise zone. And so we've had this kind of circumstance that has impacted our ability to generate revenue. So that being the case, why are we here testifying in support of enterprise zones? Because I think that enterprise zones, my council believes enterprise zones, still have a very important impact upon local economies. If, in fact, the right question is asked about those, and I think that Representative Witt was kind of focusing in on the issue that we're concerned about, and asking the right question with respect to these economic enterprise zones or economic programs in general. And the question is not really how many new jobs is an enterprise going to bring to this locality or to whatever locality you're looking at, but will that enterprise actually measurably and beneficially impact your unemployment or underemployment in the community to which this enterprise is going to locate and seek to have a taxpayer subsidy. And so that's why we support 2131, because it begins, I think, to focus more in on those kinds of things which local communities, the sponsors of enterprise zones, are able to do to make sure that enterprise zones function so as to measurably improve the unemployment and underemployment of a particular locale. And without those kinds of improvements, we found as the enterprise zone was so general that it was hard to nail down where the authority and responsibility was to monitor and exactly what were the parameters and of the criteria within which monitoring could occur. Finally, if I may, what we're finding is that the quality of life in a community is probably as every bit as important as the subsidy that one gains by, or business gains by the economic enterprise zone, although they all ask for it. There isn't a taxpayer, whether it be corporate or individual, I know of, that is willing to say, we're not interested in a tax subsidy, don't give it to us. But we had an experience where this prominent national company came to Salem and looked at our community and was offered the standard enterprise zone treatment and went to Eugene and looked at their standard enterprise zone treatment, and that was a pretty level. So how did they make a decision between the two communities? They sent their upper-level management to test the nightlife in Salem and test the nightlife in Eugene. Now, I understand by that polite guffawing that what nightlife in Salem, right?
I'm kind of amused by the comparison.
Well, we lost that economic opportunity to Eugene because of their quality or amenities, especially after dark, it appears. That company was Levi Strauss, so it was not an inconsiderable opportunity that the city of Salem lost. Finally, and I said finally before, but this is really the last finally, there have been examples both here in the state of Oregon and other places where the failure to ask how the functioning of an enterprise zone, these subsidies, impacts the unemployment or underemployment statistic has created tremendous havoc. In Fort Collins, Colorado, a few years back, Anheuser-Busch came in. They got millions of dollars worth of subsidies. And what they found out, because they kept records, was at the end of the process, the taxpayers of Fort Collins, which was about 70,000 people at that time, paid over $300,000 per job of a Fort Collins resident to be employed at Anheuser-Busch. Another company came along to Fort Collins, wanted to locate there. A few years later, they said they wanted the Anheuser-Busch program. They thought that was very nice. They'd like to have it. Fort Collins said, no, we're not doing that anymore. We're going to look at it a little more rationally. That company looked around. They located in Eugene, and that was a Hyundai company. The evidence seems to indicate that Eugene did better than Fort Collins. They paid somewhere in the neighborhood of about $50,000 for a Eugene resident that got a job at Hyundai. So bringing jobs to the community is only the beginning of the question. It certainly isn't the answer to the issue of whether or not this is going to be good or bad. But we think 2131 is a measurable improvement towards getting us to those relevant criteria.
All right.
So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions for the mayor? All right, thanks for coming in. Glad to have you today. Michael Mason, do you want to come up and talk to us briefly about the dash sixes, I guess? Bring anybody with you?
I don't know. Louis Pitt, I think, would like to join me up here, the Government Affairs Director for Warm Springs. Michael Mason, for the record, Chair Shetterly and members of the committee. We're going to make this a lot quicker than last time, and I believe a lot less confusing than last time. The whole point of this, as was testified to last week, was that we have about a 30% unemployment rate on the Warm Springs Reservation. We laid off 100 people this winter with no prospect of creating new jobs to take care of that that problem. We've had businesses refuse to locate on the reservation because of the fear of double taxation. And our inability to totally assure them that that would not happen. So with this very difficult situation, we're asking for help in two areas. One, removing the disincentive to development that that risk of double taxation carries. That's the tax credit aspect. Secondly, being able to designate a reservation enterprise zone, very, very similar to a rural enterprise zone. I think the same sorts of limits, 12 square miles within, you know, 15 mile distance and that sort of thing. One thing I want to stress, the A6s are very similar to the A4s. They make some clarifying changes on page 4, a couple of clarifying changes regarding uniformity of taxation and making sure that it's the tribal government that seeks the designation, not the eligible business. That was a, I think, mistake in the last draft. But otherwise, they're, as far as I can tell, very much the same as the dash A4s. The looking at the whole purpose of enterprise zones, you're talking about new construction, you're talking about new development. We find a flaw in the projected granted its the projected revenue impact granted it's somewhat conditional anyway, but we're looking, this is based on improvements to existing structures, existing project. That's the Pelton Round Butte project. The way this bill reads, you couldn't get the tax credit for that existing business. It has to be a new business. And if you look at it on page 1, line 19, the eligible business has to occupy or own a new business facility. And then when you look at what a new business facility does not include, on page 2 of the dash A6 amendments, line 15, and then to line 16A, it doesn't include a facility that is used in a revenue-producing enterprise the same or substantially identical to the revenue-producing enterprise which the facility was previously used. So we don't see how that, I mean, we never intended, put it that way, and we don't believe the language allows for a tax credit for something already there. I mean, that's not the enterprise zone concept. So anyway, we have a perhaps disagreement there. And I would be happy to try to answer any questions, since I promise this would be brief.
Sure. Yes, Representative Beck.
Michael, let's say a gas fire, a new gas plant wanted to locate on somewhere. Mm-hmm. Here's some power lines and wanted to locate near the dam because the power lines are there, would they benefit from this?
A new plant?
A new generation plant.
If it was met all the other requirements and met the criteria for enterprise zone. I mean, I want to say it's somewhat two-tiered, as staff was pointing out. There's the income tax credit, which would be reservation-wide, as I read it, and there's the enterprise zone property tax exemption, which are limited. They've got the 3-year limit or the 5-year limit. But conceivably, that could apply if it met all the other requirements. We have no such plan or anything approaching us, but...
Unrelated question, but are there any provisions in here, since the problem you seem to be focusing on is unemployment on the reservation, are there any provisions in here that would stipulate that the new facility would have to employ, let's say, 75% or even 50% tribal members in the new enterprise?
I don't...
Is that in here, or is that something that you folks have thought about and would consider?
Well, it's not in here. It's certainly something that we've struggled with on the reservation in general. I think Mr. Pitt has more information about efforts in that regard, but I think such a high figure would be very difficult because you're talking about being tied into the community in Madras, and you'd have a lot of folks. We don't want to cut out the opportunity of people from neighboring communities to be working there as well. So it's, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, Louis Pitt, Director of Government Affairs and Planning for Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. Yes, the Tribal Council has, I think in the last 5 years, has passed two resolutions dealing with tribal member preference. And we've had, I think, some difficulty with that because of trying to also get qualified people in qualified positions, and especially on the higher professional levels. So we like many other reservations, is that we tap human resources from surrounding communities also. So although we have a preference, is that the reality is that tribal members, unless we get apprentice programs and more people through education and get the education problem solved, is that we're going to have to tap the surrounding community. So it's been somewhat, I think, politically supported, but in reality, we have to deal with, what the resource is, and a lot of it is off-reservation. But for entry level and such, yes, we have the door open for our folks. Every project that comes through the reservation, federal, state, or otherwise, the Tribal Council does push, I think, for advancing tribal member employment in those, too. So they have a... We deal with Bureau of Indian Affairs and also Tribal Council, who is the authority when it comes to those lands as being, you can call them private properties or trust lands, but we deal with the Bureau of Indian Affairs as a partner to make sure that our folks are going to have at least a reasonable opportunity. I think opportunity is probably the key word, even though, it usually ends up where a non-Indian does get probably professional jobs, and our folks will get to entry level and other jobs that don't have high risk of bodily harm, safety, et cetera.
Can I follow up?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So either of you, help me understand the mechanics of the bill then. Let's say that we pass this and one or two or three new facilities opened up that employed, let's say, a total of 500 people. And let's say 400 of those people lived in Madras or Jefferson, across the river somewhere. And so those people now own homes, they go to school, they drive the roads 20 miles to get to Warm Springs or how far it is. And to wherever the facility is, and they might be new jobs to Jefferson County or to Madras area. Might be new people who've moved in. what would this new enterprise that's creating, its enterprises that are creating these jobs, what would they, under this bill, be contributing to the community where those people are living? Obviously, some property tax from the homes they're living in, but what would the business contribute to the community that was drawing most of its employees from? What would they contribute to that community to help pay for services under this bill?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Beck, certainly there's income tax for all of those people, whether they're Indian or not.
Mm-hmm.
They're living, I mean, you have to both live on and work on the reservation to be exempt from state income tax.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone coming in from Madras would pay income
tax.
The, you know, that 10-mile drive to the reservation, you know, depending on where we put, where the new development was placed, once they get on the reservation, it's all, you know, tribally maintained roads and law enforcement and so forth. But I think that you're looking at a situation that's somewhat similar to the situation faced by folks going back and forth across state lines,
mm-hmm.
as well. But
yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, that's a question that comes up with a number of our relationships with the counties, and it depends on our relationship with the county. So with the services that I learned about this when we were thinking about housing off reservation for tribal employees near the reservation about 3 miles away, a place called Schoenhagen. And so what we do is to sit down and negotiate with them what, you know, as partners to service a community that benefits us both and just work it out. Because quite simply, like when it comes to ambulance type services, to try to put a new ambulance out there or a fire district out there is very expensive for us. And so we partner within that to make sure there's a reasonable risk because of the distance. And then, you know, we work it out. So it's a similar question because, you know, where people house themselves is we've even thought about partnering with Madras about some housing over there to help ourselves. Because, you know, we need that. We need Madras with the housing because the reservation folks, we are very possessive of the reservation as ours. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
You said you understand this. So under this bill, under this bill, then there would be no property tax revenue being generated. Well, obviously, no property tax revenue. There'd be no state income, business income tax revenue being generated to the state, I guess.
Sure.
Property tax revenue would go to the tribe if they chose to assess. How does that work? You have $100 million assessment that's on the reservation. They're tax exempt now?
No property tax if they're in a, if they qualify for the urban.
No. Mr. Chairman, Representative Beck, we're talking about
mechanics.
We're talking about new construction.
Rural, right.
We're talking about a new construction
zone.
Currently, it would have to be the way this is written on trust land. There's already no tax from that.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it would be like other rural enterprise zones that you would have that tax break for 3 years. In rare instances, I don't think it would apply here 5 years. Right. It's hard for me to see how we would get anything that could meet that five-year requirement. There would be a period of time, but that's, you know, an incentive period for businesses in economically disadvantaged areas like ours.
So there is no limit on the number of years for the income tax credit?
Right, apparently not, yeah.
Right. Representative Bates?
I'm only sure that I understand this, and so I'm going to go through the mechanics the way Representative Beck just did. Without this law, if this law were not in place, and a non-tribal business was set up on the reservation, they would be taxed by the tribal tax of 5% on the property, not the land, but the property. Would they also be assessed a tax by the local county and the state on that property? Is that the double tax we're talking about?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Representative Bates said we don't even get to the point to have a company on the reservation because of just the threat of double tax.
But that is the double tax we're talking about.
So if I may clarify, Mr. Chairman and Representative Bates, we don't have a tax now on the Warm Springs. We have a tax commission, but we have not determined what taxes we could even collect. You're talking about the situation on the Umatilla Reservation right now, which is there's a property tax, tribal property tax that's imposed. We don't have that. And so we're in a situation of not even imposing a tax, even though we are providing the services.
To follow up, yeah. Though, the tax credit would offset then the taxes that would do, that are threatened to be, in your case, threatened to be levied against this new business, and that's what you're looking for here, to prevent double taxation for these businesses.
That's correct. It'd be a wash for the business. Right now, we try to impose a tax, we'll run a business. We've already done. I mean, businesses have already been run off without us even threatening to impose a tax or having a tax code, but just the threat of it, or the potential.
I was going to say, threat is probably, I don't know if I'd buy into that word, maybe potential.
Potential.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a better word, mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, you're right.
Okay. All right, I want to get some more testimony on this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Riddell, do you want to come up with your guests?
Thank you for the opportunity.
You bet. Thank you, Michael. Yes, right.
Okay. Welcome.
Welcome, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mike Morgan, the County Administrative Officer in Jefferson County, and we're here, myself and Paul Hathaway, the County Counsel on my right, at the request of the Jefferson County Commissioners, speaking to, I want to use the correct terminology here, I'm not familiar with this process, 2131. My last amendment that I have is the -A4. I understand that Paul has an A6, and we had emailed to us from one of the legal counsels representing the tribes today another modification that I haven't had a chance to read. I'm not sure if it's made it to your attention yet.
We've got the A4s and the A6s.
Okay. The County Commission doesn't want to oppose this legislation, but right now they're asking that action not be taken on it for three principal reasons. One is time. We first saw our first version of this legislation Tuesday. I had my first telephone conversation with a representative of the tribes Tuesday at about 9 o'clock in the morning. It was Jim Notham, I'm sorry, on a long-distance phone call. We received our first hard copy at 11 o'clock that morning. We had our first joint work session with one county commissioner and some staff at 1:30 that afternoon, raised a variety of questions, and were able to arrange a 3:30 meeting tomorrow with Jim Nofum to work our way through the questions, issues, concerns, and multiple agency impacts that we see with this proposal. And the tone that we're trying to set here very diligently is that we, too, have a mutual concern with the tribe. We want to come out of this with a cooperative and agreeable agreement. But the way it stands right now, we have bad medicine when we rush into it, and that's our concern. We just haven't had a chance to sit down and go through the questions. The other issue is complexity. Former Representative Bill Bellamy asked me to share this quote. This is a very complex tax issue. Jefferson County is dependent and relying on the legislature to make sure that this is good, sound tax policy for local government and the state. And it is indeed complex. In our first review, Paul was back there reading it again, raising even more concerns, all of which may be legitimately answered and put aside. But it's that unintended consequence that gives us the greatest cause. We were very supportive, for example,